The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it, we can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Happy first day of Jukai for those of you who've come early, and for those of you who perhaps are here for the first time. This is the first day of a week-long retreat, which is probably the most important retreat we do every year. It's the retreat where people come either to take the Buddhist precepts for the first time or to renew their commitment to the precepts. And so it'll all be starting this evening. This morning I'd like to talk about contentment. This came to me because every year in February we commemorate the Buddha's parinirvana, the Buddha's death. And we have a festival ceremony on a Sunday where we recite scriptures. However, another part of it is that during the 2 weeks prior to that observance, the community assembles and we read together aloud the scripture of the Buddha's last teachings. And every year the same thing strikes me, and it struck me again this year, and so I decided to talk about it. And what I'd like to talk about is contentment. Because in the scripture of the Buddha's last teachings, you know, the scene is set, the Buddha is dying, he's lying beneath the solid trees. The whole community, you know, hundreds, who knows how many monks are all assembled there. And the Buddha is about to talk to them about the most important aspects of the teaching that he's given them over a lifetime of teaching, 45 years of teaching. And so you can imagine the kinds of things he might speak of. He talks about the importance of following the precepts, of regulating your sense desires, of not cultivating anger and hatred, of cultivating diligence, wisdom. And in the middle of all of that, he gives one big, what is shown in our writing of it, one big paragraph on contentment. And I'd like to read that to you to begin with. O you monks, if you wish to be free from miseries and woes, look into contentment, which is synonymous with knowing what is enough. The teaching of contentment is none other than the location of true wealth, ease, security, and peace. The person who is contented, though he sleep on the bare ground, is still at ease and satisfied. Someone who is discontented, even if he were ensconced within a celestial palace, would still not find this tallying with his ideas and tastes. The one who is discontented, though rich, is poor. The person who is contented, though poor, is rich. The one who is discontented always latches onto what his five desires latch onto. He does that which causes grief to and arouses the compassionate pity of one who is contented. This is what I mean by the term contentment. 24 years ago, I came from my first Jukai. And I had, although I didn't know it at the time, what was my first taste of contentment. At that time, you know, the retreat was the same length of time, but since we didn't have the renewal of vows as the final ceremony, you had five big ceremonies of Jukai in 6 days. So there was a day right in the middle where nothing in particular was scheduled. You know, we got up, we meditated, we had morning service, we had our meals, we did working meditation. No star event. Ordinary daily life. And when I left Jukai, although the ceremonies were wonderful. The thing that stuck in my mind was what that one day felt with. And I never forgot that, but it took quite a while for me to understand what it was I had experienced. What I had experienced is a brief taste of contentment, which is synonymous with knowing what is enough. So knowing what is enough is what I'm going to be exploring today. And I'm going to use a number of passages from Reverend Master Daishin Morgan's book, Buddha Recognizes Buddha, because there are certain aspects of this which he articulates more beautifully than I could ever hope to. So I'll be using some brief descriptions from his text. I'd like to start with looking at some of the things that we take refuge in, thinking that they are the path to contentment. And it's interesting because these things popped into my head, and you know, contentment starts with C-O-N. Most of these do too, or C-O-M. I mean, I almost felt like I was giving a Dharma talk emphasizing alliteration. The first is comfort. In our society and in much of the, certainly the Western world and gradually spreading to the entire world, we are surrounded by promises of things that we can have. It's not just advertisements and so forth. We see what everyone has around us. The idea of comfort can become a sense of entitlement. You know, the ads tell us you deserve the very best, right? In a sense, when the Buddha talked about the discontented person who was ensconced in a celestial palace, I suppose that if the people of his time saw most of us, we would be pretty close to the celestial palace that they could all imagine at that time. We have physical comfort, we have clothing, we have shoes, we have beds, we have all of these things in abundance. And I can never resist tossing in kind of my pet example, which is sheets and towels. The purpose of a sheet is to keep your blankets clean. Right? That, so you don't have to launder blankets all the time. And towels are something you do to get dry. But if you go to any department store, there's a section almost as big as this room that's filled with sheets and towels. In my experience, if you like sheets and towels, it's kind of discouraging because the things don't wear out fast enough so that you can buy new ones. You know, a set of sheets will probably last you 10 years. And if you read novels of previous centuries, one of the things that women did was regularly mend the linens. You know, when was the last time you mended your linens? So it's clearly not a case of having an abundance of these things because there's a large, true demand. That's a celestial palace right there. It's a candy shop. For those of you who are not shoppers, this probably makes no sense at all. But I think some people do the same thing in hardware stores. A big area of comfort is our health. We're all familiar with the phrase which we either hear others use or use ourselves. You get a twinge or a what or something and you say to yourself, there's something wrong. You know. We want to live as long as possible and we don't want to experience what happens to a body that tries to do that. we set up kind of an impossible dilemma for ourselves because we can't fill our hopes of living to, you know, 70 or 80 or 90 or 100 or whatever we're hoping to, feeling like we're 17. But somehow we think we should. Something's wrong. There's something wrong. Think of the term comfort zone. It's like we've drawn a line in the sand. I'm willing to accept this much and no more. I want the room to be no cooler than 68 and no warmer than 72. You know. Or I'll get cranky and if you're lucky, you'll hear about it. You know. But we do that all the time, not just with temperature, with all the other things which have to do with our body ease, bodily ease. The other thing that we like and we think will make us contented is if our life is convenient. It's kind of our strategy for getting through life with ease. And the examples I could think of mostly come with a price. Some, you know, if things are going to be convenient for me, either I have to pay extra or you're going to have to pay. Convenience stores are around the corner, but they cost more, right? If you want to go in the carpool lane, you have to go to all the trouble of bringing somebody else in your car, which is not convenient, but you can go faster. If you pay extra, you can go online and reserve your airplane reservation, but it costs more. But that way you can be sure that when you're at 30,000 feet, you'll have the view that you desire out the window, you know, if that's what you want. Convenience for ourselves often causes inconvenience for other people. Outside here, there are shoe racks. How many of you automatically take the top shelf? Because it's, you know, I mean, you don't have to bend all the way down there. But if you choose the top shelf, what you're saying is, it's okay for those other people. I want my coat rack to be the one closest to the door. I want my parking place at work to be the closest one to the door. The other people can be, although we don't think about that, can be satisfied with something else. I deserve it. I deserve the very best. So we go through times where we make varying amounts of effort to do whatever we can to make sure that the path of our life is smooth, that things are easy for us. We also take refuge in competence. It's safe. We think of ourselves as, I am the one who knows always how to fix leaking faucets and, you know, all of these kinds of things. Or I am who knows all the best recipes for what to do with, you know, eggplants. I'm an expert. People respect me for it. It gives me ease because I know I'm competent and I don't have to have what I'm doing accompanied by any sense of worry. I used to think, although someone once challenged me for my use of these words, that wouldn't it be nice if you could be wholeheartedly mediocre at doing something? You know you don't do it very well, but you do it as wholeheartedly as you throw yourself into baking bread because you know you can do a good job. There's probably a better word than mediocre, but I haven't come up with one that kind of pricks my ego the same way as mediocre does. Now, you've probably may have noticed that all of the things I've just talked about are aspects of control. Because we live within conditions, millions and billions of conditions. And the conditions have an effect on how our life goes. What we would really like is to achieve liberation from conditions. And perhaps we can, but not in the way we think we can. We're kind of stuck with the idea that, you know, we've probably always all said at one time or another, if you want something done right, you got to do it yourself. That's sort of the ultimate attempt at control over whatever the conditions are. In many ways, we can go through life fighting a sort of a war or battle with conditions. They're always coming at us, and we're always looking for a way of being comfortable in the midst of all of that. And we think that if we win, we'll be contented. Which, by the way, is, the dictionary says, is being pleased and satisfied and not needing more. So we go through life, we try to choose who to be with, where to be, what to eat, when to sleep, how to play, what to wear, and possibly the most important of all is how to use time. All of this is a way that we think will bring satisfaction. The other extreme of that is we think, who wants to be contented? Because contented sounds like some sort of neutral, colorless condition without any excitement or joy or pleasure. And contentment is so much more than all of that. I don't think that the Buddha would have expended his breath in his dying talk to the monks to talk about something dull, neutral, and colorless. The Buddha said that contentment is knowing what is enough. Okay. This is what Reverend Master Daishin has to say about how we live within the conditions of our life. We can choose only a few of the conditions that make up our life. It is important to choose wisely. But more than that, we need to understand that whatever the conditions are that are present in this moment, they are the conditions that complete our lives. Conditions may show their completeness through revealing what is to be done, but deeper than that is the completeness occurring at every moment. Completeness does not come with fulfilling some act, nor is it something that is present from the start. It does not depend on any condition. It is consummate acceptance. So he's taking a step toward describing how our relationship with conditions of our life need to be. It needs to be. And he's opening the idea of acceptance of conditions, which again doesn't mean, you know, like this. If contentment is knowing what is enough, how do we know what that means? It's definitely not how little can I get by with. You know, this morning we enjoyed an offering of donuts for breakfast. And none of us, I think, crossed their mind to say, it's all right, I'll just have a half a bowl of rice gruel, you know. The donuts appeared, that was the condition. We enjoyed the donuts. We accepted the donuts. The Buddha certainly emphasized that asceticism is not an example of knowing what is enough either. And this includes all kinds of things. Typically, we might just think of what for monks are the four requisites: food, medicine, clothing, shelter. But it's other things. It's temperature. What is enough in the way of control over what the temperature? Being with other people. How much do we need to control that? What is enough? And you can spread it out into global concerns, peace and war, environment, politics, all of those things. What is enough? Is my involvement enough? Am I becoming one-sided and rabid on certain issues? Wonderful though they may be, what is enough? What is good to do? There is one of the clues to deciding what is enough. How much is good for me to eat? What is enough? River Master Daishin brings up an interesting topic right in the middle of this discussion of dealing with conditions. He has a whole chapter in his book on hope. Because quite often, we're familiar with dealing with our greeds and our angers as being opposites, you might say, on a spectrum. Hope and despair are actually different faces of greed and anger, and ones that we don't necessarily consider in that light. Hope is good. There's a hospital ship named that. Hope is good, despair is bad. And we experience this in really common ways that aren't particularly dramatic. I'm really exhausted. I just can't cope. I'm tired. It's hopeless. I don't know what to do. But maybe I can get some rest this weekend. If I can just crawl to the weekend, maybe I can get out of this pit that I feel myself in, caused by exhaustion. Or I'm busy. I have so much to do, I can't possibly get it all done. It's hopeless. But maybe somebody will give me a break and they'll take some of it and give it to someone else to do. Or, maybe I can work late. We leap from one to the other without ever sitting still in the middle of it. I'm sick. I feel awful. I have a serious illness. Maybe I'll die. Or maybe there's a miracle cure. Or maybe I can live for another year or a month or whatever. It's kind of a ricochet effect that goes on and on and on. If hope is the cure for despair, and that's usually how we treat it. I worked a long time ago with a woman who was very courageous, probably in her late 50s, early 60s, through the help of a 12-step program, she actually became sober for the first time in her life. And very shortly after that, she went through the death of her husband, who, died in her home before the ambulance could get there. And she, none of that knocked her off her feet. She was just right there, solid. And then she started getting a pain right in her side here. And it went on and on and on and on and on. 9 months later, the pain is still going on. But what she had done is she was so afraid of what the pain was, all she could do is hope that it would go away. Because the alternative of knowing what the answer was more than she could bear. And so hope led her down a path which eventually, you can imagine the results of that. Sooner or later, she had to deal with it. Fortunately, it was all right. But she was in hell for 9 months. Her courage, when it came to that particular instance, that her courage failed. Reverend Master Daishin talks about one of the problems with hope. He says, hope is all about the future. At its best, it motivates us to act in order to bring about the hoped-for ends. At its worst, it is a sentimental feeling conjured up to mask the real causes of suffering. When hope involves the cultivation of dissatisfaction with the present, it is destructive. It is useful to distinguish between a positive outlook on life and the kind of hope that depends on future attainments to bring fulfillment. So what he's saying is hope can mask reality, and that's an important point. Because the pathway to contentment, interestingly enough, requires us to meet reality, to meet face-to-face the actual conditions of our life. And guess where we learn how to do that? We're right back to the practice of meditation. Meditation is where we meet the actual of our life. And in the actual of our life, right now, is the only place that contentment ever happens. Contentment never happens in the future. And although I can remember 24 years ago at Jukai, I'm remembering my memory. I'm not able to remanufacture what it actually was like to experience contentment. And that's important because a lot of times we confuse the memory with the experience. You know, once we've experienced something, we think we remember what it was like, and so we go about trying to recreate it. And there we are, back again controlling conditions. Meditation is the place that we learn to see and to be what we are, nothing else. Now, when we sit down on the cushion, we may do a lot of other things, but when we're meditating, we're actually seeing who and what we are. We're seeing the unfolding of our life. And the unfolding of our life may be watching ourselves worry about what we're going to do tomorrow. The worry is the unfolding of what our life is doing right now. And so if you are observing the worry, it's difficult to worry at the same time. It's interesting. We prove and prove again, there's no such thing as multitasking. Recently, I heard someone say that multitasking means thinking about the thing that you're not doing. So, while doing the thing that you're not thinking about. The unfolding of life, when we see it in its fullness, is actually observing and experiencing our interconnection with all of existence. And I can't explain that, but we have all experienced it. The time when we're sitting in meditation and there's more there than just this little me. And I don't know what that all is. It's a place that we can experience that. Now, interestingly enough, River Master Daishin says that the precepts, which we will be taking this week, that the precepts are one way of describing this interconnection. Because to live by the precepts is a way to acknowledge that life isn't just me, and all of you happen to be the people that are looking at me right now. You know, it's I'm separate, and we have no thing in common in this moment as we're experiencing it. But in fact, you know, if I talk to one of you at tea and you tell me something interesting, and, you know, when I talk to my aunt, I tell her that, and, you know, all the time we experience this interconnection, and the precepts are the way of living within that interconnection with doing as little harm as possible. If we sit in meditation, or if we meditate wherever we are, and we're learning to see and be what we are and nothing else, then if I'm sitting there and tempted to fall into despair because I'm busy and I don't know what to do about that, if I sit and experience what it feels like to be busy, there's no space for despair. And I won't give more examples of that, because you can all put them right in. It goes for when, no matter what you're experiencing, to experience it fully removes the space for internal commentary on it. When I first started to meditate, I was up here for a retreat, and I asked to see someone for spiritual counseling, and I said, I cannot stand this because there's someone in my head who is just like the guy on the golf course. You know, the guy that talks really soft and says, you know, what's his name is coming up. You know, it's he always, there's this commentary going on in this little voice. And I said, I can't stand it because I can't do anything without sitting there and saying, you know, Maxine is sitting on her cushion, you know. And the person said, don't worry about it, it'll go away. And she was right. You know, other types of commentaries appeared, but at least that, you know, the one, it was almost as though I couldn't give myself permission to experience my own life without recording it somehow. It's as though something wonderful happened to me, and it doesn't become real unless I grab one of you and tell you, you know what happened to me? Well, then it kind of validates that this was a wonderful experience. When we learn to see and be what we are and nothing else, a lot of that falls away, and we can actually see clearly without having to describe ourselves to ourselves. And I just threw one of these little markers off, and I hope it isn't the wrong one. To explore the actual beyond hope and despair is one way of describing meditation. To come to know reality or the actual, we need to see how deeply we are tied to notions of gain and loss. For many people, the actual is experienced as anxiety. Does that ring any bells? This is the consequence of giving hope and fear the steering wheel of our lives. And so, back again to those two opposites of bouncing between what we're afraid is going to happen and what we hope will happen. That's one way of describing anxiety, is to live. And what often happens is, when we despair, we say, I shouldn't, I should hope. You know, and so we continue trapping ourselves. I like that, giving it the steering wheel of our lives. Now, acceptance of the actual is more than just a path to contentment. Acceptance is one of the most profound aspects of training, and yet many of us struggle with it. To accept means to receive what is offered. Is it enough? The circumstances of life give rise to conditions, and our acceptance of these conditions is just the acceptance of things as they are. What is not meant in the Buddhist idea of acceptance is any agreement or disagreement with the way things are. To accept the situation is to be grounded in the actual state of things. So to take what's offered. You hear people use the phrase, this is what's in my begging bowl right now. What's in my begging bowl is that I've been given entirely too much to do and I don't know what to do about it. That's what's in my begging bowl. My begging bowl is I have a migraine and I can barely keep my eyes open. But yet I'm supposed to be somewhere doing something. This is what's in my begging bowl right now. I accept it. It's to choose it. Acceptance is acknowledging that the unity of our life and the situation we find ourselves in is not two things. It's one. When you have a migraine, that is what life is at that moment. Now, we come to the point which I think many of us struggle with, and that is to hear teachings like these and to hear things that Reverend Master Daishin is describing, and to decide to try to put them into practice requires a huge amount of faith and trust. You hear of leaps of faith. It is a leap of faith because it requires us to take a chance. It's much easier to buy a fast pass and go the convenient way and think that that will bring us contentment. It's much easier to take some of those refuges to try to find contentment. What this requires is that we actually do this thing where, you know, when you first get in the water and you're a little kid and they tell you you can float and you say, right. Yeah. You have to let go with both hands. And do you remember the miracle, what it felt like that first time? You can't experience it again. The first time you discovered that it was true, that water would actually hold you up. I mean, I was so excited, I sank. We have to believe we can float. Which means that we have to try to go through life without a steering wheel. Because the steering wheel doesn't work so good. And here is perhaps the answer. Or a clue. Although there cannot be acceptance without our participation, you have to let go. It helps to think of acceptance not so much as something that we do, as our true state. Acceptance and reality are the same thing. Acceptance is a state of being in accord with reality. And within that, right there, is where contentment dwells. Now, it's very tempting to think about conditions, you know, awful ones. What am I going to do if a tsunami comes, you know? Well, who knows? I think for some people, that's the place where they actually find acceptance and contentment, is within something big. But we can start right now. And if we don't start right now, well, we can start. I mean, every moment is the place you can start. So the opportunity to find contentment happens all the time. You know, I can't even count how many times there's space for that in a single day. And we start by the basic thing we learned at the very beginning when we came to this practice of sitting still and seeing what is actually in front of us. Until we do that, contentment will elude us. We need to recognize that there's no need to label anything. We don't need to have an opinion about anything in our life. Good, bad, whatever, fun, awful. That's like me trying to remember that Jukai 24 years ago. If I say this is a terrible experience, I'm no longer experiencing the experience. We need to, it doesn't mean we lose words in our life, but we need to learn to experience things without comment. We need to refrain from allowing hope and fear to be in charge. We need to allow conditions to inform us, because if we're sitting still, a condition will show what needs to be done. And it doesn't necessarily mean that we need to do it either. Just this is what needs to be done. If we allow conditions to inform us as to what needs to be done, this is how we're keeping that pure precept of do only good. That's where it is right within the condition itself. So we don't need to wait for war and famine and pestilence and all of those things to learn how to be truly accepting. If we start now, we'll be ready for tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow. Right now, just right now, just this is what's absolutely enough. And I'd like to close by reading the first page of Reverend Master Daishin's book, because I keep rereading this and I find it extremely inspiring. He says, "Everyone would like to make sense of life, but for some people, the need to explore life's meaning cannot be ignored. This need may have been awakened in us by experiencing particular events, or it may have been felt for as long as we can remember. To know such a call is to feel its insistence. Having felt it, one can hide by running to distractions of one kind or another, but whenever there is a pause in the business of life, it is there, awaiting our response. This call is the greatest blessing imaginable, and it sometimes feels like torture. Even though it makes so many demands, we would be bereft without it. When we are able to acknowledge the presence of the wish, then the wish sets all the priorities of life. The insistence of the wish drives us to understand the wish itself. It is the wish that draws us to meditation. We may have rational reasons for meditating and undertaking Buddhist practice, but I suggest that what calls us is something much more fundamental. It may be that we have no explanation. All we know is that there is something here of the greatest importance, and that we cannot let our lives go by without exploring it to the full. Buddhism does not contain it, and no path defines it. And yet we need guidance and some frame of reference to work within. Idealism may suggest we can manage without a commitment to any one path, but experience shows such idealism is easily subverted by one's ego. Sometimes I am tired and irritable, vulnerable to self-doubt and desire reassurance from others. And yet, in each moment, what does all that amount to but a shadow that lends depth to the scenery? Thank you.